Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a look at the importance of interfaith relationships and ties in American culture, plus a look at the re-examination that many American Protestant denominations are undergoing as this century unfolds. Many mainstream Protestant churches are in increasing distress. Every day, 9 U.S. churches close their doors for good. Pastors and boards view increasing U.S. statistics and surveys which show a growth in none for religious choice warily. My guest today is the editor and publisher of Christian Century magazine, but for 26 years he was the senior pastor at one of the largest Presbyterian churches in the country, Fourth Presbyterian Church in Chicago. Dr. John Buchanan will be giving the KNIPA Interfaith Ecumenical Lecture this Sunday evening, January 25th at 7 o'clock at Grace Lutheran Church at Fifth Place in Lewis. He'll be borrowing a phrase from Donald Rumsfeld for his lecture title, Known Knowns, Known Unknowns, and Unknown Unknowns, a prelude to hopeful interfaith relationships. And the lecture is free to the public. Buchanan has served in a variety of leadership positions in the Presbyterian Church USA and was moderator of the church in 1996 and 97. Also served on the board of the National Council of Churches. And he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Dr. Buchanan, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
As you know, when we look at churches' interfaith relationships, churches tend to come together into serious interfaith relationships, usually in times of crisis, things like Ferguson, and usually they're tragedies, you know, where the community sort of comes together. What is the value to a community by having a strong interfaith relationship that is working even outside of times of crisis?
Well, my personal opinion that interfaith relationships are a highest priority for people of faith. Of all opinions and ideologies, conservative to liberal, not only because of the immediacy of the crises, and of course we're in yet another one right now, given the tragedy in Paris, but long term, it seems to me the future of religion for the human race has to be one of at least more interfaith dialogue and communication and understanding and respect. Clearly, we can't envision a very hopeful future if religious violence, tribalism that spawns religious violence, continues to accelerate. Hans Kung, the very distinguished Roman Catholic scholar, said several times some years ago that there will be no world peace until there's peace between world religions, and there will be no peace between world religions until there is honest and authentic dialogue between religions. So I think it's just simply a top priority.
Now, there is honest and open dialogue between a number of segments of religious interfaith organizations, but really when you think of a faith organization, they're based on the fact that their approach is the right approach. I mean, that goes for practically any religion, doesn't it?
Well, some propose that all religions are basically that way and basically tribal, but there is within the religions, there is another counterpoint to that exclusive notion that ours is the right way, which leads pretty quickly to ours is the only way, which leads pretty quickly to yours is a really wrong way, and we need to disabuse you of your way. Anyhow, there's a counterpoint to that. Within the biblical tradition and also the New Testament tradition, there is a counterpoint of openness and respect and a sense of mystery about those ultimate issues. And it's that I think we need to be talking about and thinking about and gathering around.
How are ways we can do that?
Strategically, there are councils and organizations like the fine one in Tulsa that foster this sort of conversation all around. And I think there is a level of that going on now that's rather unprecedented. We don't pay much attention to it, but as you correctly pointed out, we don't get around to doing this until someone blows something up in the name of religion, and then we think, oh my gosh. And it's ironic, and all of us know this, at 9/11, we were really blindsided, not only militarily, but until 9/11, theological curricula, for instance, didn't really include a whole lot about world religions, and certainly not much about Islam. And working professionals my age had to confess we didn't know a thing about Islam. We didn't study it. We weren't required to investigate it or talk about it. So anyhow, I think we are making progress on that front. There are conversations, I think, in every major city. between Jews and Christians, and they've been going on for some time, but now we've got the Islamic participation. There's a wonderful, wonderful conversation in Chicago that I'm not personally part of, but part of the people with whom I worked at Fourth Presbyterian are instrumental in keeping that conversation alive and well. So I think there's reason to be hopeful that we are, for the first time perhaps, on a kind of major scale, talking to one another and entertaining ideas that heretofore would have been pretty alien, and that is that we owe one another respect and space, and that we have something to learn from one another.
Now, this weekend, when you give the KNIPA Interfaith Ecumenical Lecture, you're going to use a famous quote by Donald Rumsfeld as far as interfaith relationships go. Can you give us some examples of what you're talking about?
Well, I think the best example is the one that you already cited, and that is the propensity of religions to go from we have the truth to we have the only truth, and that you don't have truth. And I'd like to suggest that at the end of that equation, there is mystery, and that we need to adopt practices of theological modesty, and to say that that God remains revealed to Christians and revealed to other religions, but God remains ultimately a mystery, and that's what the unknown unknowns are about. And there are biblical incidents that are, I think, just brilliantly underscore that, as well as this long theological tradition of respecting the mystery at the end of the day and not claiming to know too much. I will refer to a character who's kind of an obscure character, Nicholas of Cusa, C-U-S-A. He lived in the 1400s, and that was his kind of theological specialty. To claim that you know everything is the worst kind of ignorance, and the wisest stance of all is to say there remains mystery, that we know one of us on the basis of our intellects or our spirits has total access to.
Now, one of the things you were talking about all the interfaith organizations that are out there, but a lot of times it's the leaderships. It's not the grassroots churches, temples, mosques that are getting together and trying to have interfaith relationships. Is that more important, or is it just the leadership that can really foster these conversations better?
Well, I think one way that happens is it begins with leaders talking to one another, mm-hmm. And then bringing people along. I think there's a palpable hunger for interfaith relationships. I think to read the newspaper today, this morning, is at least in part to want to know what motivates these people to commit massacres in the name of their religion, shouting, "God is great." So I think there's a great curiosity, but also a great thirst and hunger for open dialogue. We've had some experience at Fourth Presbyterian in Chicago with our neighboring synagogue, Congregation Sinai. And for 15 or 20 years now, there have been regular interfaith events, conversations, Bible studies, mission projects, and people do respond to that when given the opportunity.
Now, one of the things you write now as editor and publisher of Christian Centuries, looking at the various issues affecting Protestant Christian churches, and it seems to me, you know, you look at the Catholic Church, for example. Pope Francis seems to be leading a major re-examination of what it means to be Catholic in the 21st century. Do you get a similar sense that Protestant leaders are doing that in their own churches?
Well, as everybody now knows, the mainline churches in the United States are all in the middle of a kind of a massive shake-up and reconfiguration. We don't have a central authority. We don't have a hierarchy or a pope, so it's a little bit hard to pin it down. There is no one person leading this thing, but all the denominations are experiencing the disintegration of some of their most important and sacred projects and programs, and things are reconfiguring in the mainline church world. So it's a little hard to see it. But it's going on, and there's great energy on a new frontier in the Presbyterian family. There are new worshiping communities sponsored by the National Church springing up all over the place, and they're unlike typical and traditional new church developments. They're casual. They're not very highly structured. They rely an awful lot on the people who are belonging to them and who are energized by them, and they're very creative, and it's kind of a bottom-up reconfiguration of Protestantism. So it's a little bit hard to see it as clearly as you can when the Pope Francis is in the paper and on television every day.
But do you think that there is a similar reexamination, or do you think most Protestant faiths are still resisting that sort of critical self-examination?
Well, I think the answer to both is yes. Yes, there's a great resistance. That's not a surprise to anybody. People hang on to traditions for dear life, and even as structures are dissolving around them, there's a great intensity that if we just hang on tighter, this thing is going to, this ship is going to right itself. But there is both within Roman Catholicism and Protestantism a very energetic willingness to rethink the structures and to rethink the traditions, and it's a really exciting time.
I was reading your magazine, Christian Century, and there was a recent story that said, you know, 9 U.S. churches are closing their doors every day.
Right.
There, you had a corollary op-ed that said, you know, I think you said you're sort of focused on the growth of nuns, and that is the, you know, the religious affiliation, the growth of nuns as a part of the average American saying they have no religious affiliations. Is that a good thing to focus on, or is that perhaps looking in the wrong direction?
Well, I think it's wrong to obsess about it. I mean, there is a kind of natural trajectory. It's not a surprise to everybody that that young adults, you know, starting in adolescence and going up through mid-20s, have been pretty absent from institutional religion historically. And that's no surprise. People get married and have kids and come back to church. Not to minimize it, it's much, much bigger than that today. But there is at least that dynamic that we need to acknowledge. Some of this is not brand new. But when the millennials, the people, I don't know exactly what the age thing is, but under 30 or under 35, the biggest growth there are people who claim no religious affiliation. So what hasn't declined, though, is kind of the soft term spirituality. There's a great book, American Grace, How Religion Unites and Divides Us, by Robert Putnam and David Campbell, I believe, from Notre Dame. Putnam's from Harvard. And they do an awful lot of good statistical research, and they're pretty clear that people are buying religious literature. They're going to seminars. When you ask them about their religious opinions, they say, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. And what does that mean? Well, it means they're still asking questions. They're still alive. And so I'm not wringing my hands in despair. The structures aren't as robust as they once were, but they will be again. We'll slowly figure this thing out, and structures will grow up that'll minister to people and attract people. And because there's a kind of innate human curiosity, innate human respect for mystery, an innate curiosity about ultimate issues, and that doesn't go away no matter what's happening in the ecclesiastical world.
Is it up to the church to find out a way in which they can talk about these issues in a way that attracts those people that have been disillusioned by the traditional structures?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think there's lots of evidence that happens, that churches that do that, Putnam and Campbell, for instance, when they asked the nuns what turns you off about the churches, the large majority of them say, well, it's what we hear about religion on television and the media. And it's pretty mean, and it's anti-this and anti-that, and it's hostile to same-sex marriage, it's hostile to reproductive rights, it's hostile to this and that, and they get tired of that. Churches that are not obsessed with those hot-button issues and are open and intellectually honest and asking big questions and dealing with big issues, I think are compelling.
My guest today is Dr. John Buchanan, the pastor emeritus at Fourth Presbyterian Church in Chicago. He led that congregation, one of the largest Presbyterian churches, for over 20 years. And he's now been 3 years away from leading that congregation. He's still the editor and publisher of Christian Century magazine. He'll be giving the 28th annual KNIPA Interfaith Ecumenical Lecture this Sunday evening at 7 o'clock at Grace Lutheran Church, speaking on interfaith relationships using a quote by Donald Rumsfeld, known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you've been 3 years away from leading a congregation, and you're still very much involved with Christian Century magazine, but has that given you new insight into the challenges and opportunities for your typical mainline Protestant church?
Well, it certainly has, Rich. The Christian Century is read pretty broadly by a broad swath of mainline people, and some evangelicals as well, and some Roman Catholics, but to be in that office a couple of days a week is to be in touch with that broader and deeper faith community in the American culture than from any particular denominational perspective. We're pretty broad in our readership, and we do hear from people, and we attempt to address that that breadth and not be parochial and provincial. And I hear from a lot of people, letters to the editor, people who agree and don't agree, and to live. I like to think of the magazine as a conversation between people who care deeply about basic faith issues and basic cultural issues and big issues of equality and hope, and it's just a very lively place to be. So yes, I'm very privileged to be associated with the magazine.
Has your thinking evolved since stepping away from running a day-to-day, you know, your church was a very large church. It was, you have probably had a big staff, but at the same time, it's sort of a full-time job just taking care of that church and doing the thinking you need to think for your own congregants. When you get to a bigger stage of, say, looking at Protestant affairs and overall church business and church structure, has that evolved your thinking about new ideas about how to better serve a Protestant faith?
Well, it has. I think any time we open ourselves to conversations with people that are different, it's a good thing. And out of that comes newness and creativity. So, yes, absolutely. I did serve as editor-publisher during the last several years of my time at Fourth Church, mm-hmm. So it's not brand new to me. But I thought when I was functioning as a pastor, I thought the Christian Century experience was an opportunity to deepen and broaden my own perceptions and my own thinking about church and about what happens on Sunday morning. So I continue to appreciate that. I'm not with the church anymore, but I am still very grateful for the opportunity to be involved in that magazine.
Earlier you were talking about things that turn off the nuns, and that's sort of the negative aspects, the exclusionary elements of religion. And you wrote recently about marriage equality's long-term effect on Christian religion and sort of noted the anomaly of the church accusing gay people of promiscuous lifestyles while creating these religious barriers against any sort of permanent relationships. What do you think the marriage equality's effect on Christian religion is likely to be long-term?
Well, I think long-term it's going to be a gradual acceptance and affirmation until it simply becomes part of the cultural furniture. It is that in a growing number of congregations and denominations in the United States right now. The cultural change on this has been huge and almost unprecedented. I'm not a historian, but I can't think of any issue about which American culture changed quite so quickly and dramatically from a large plurality of people who just would think same-sex marriage is unthinkable just a very few years ago to people who are now saying, well, we began to see the rightness of this, the fairness, the equality, and the fact that the sky isn't going to fall. It's not a threat to heterosexual marriage, never was, never will be. It's simply an extension of a right that most of us take for granted and a blessing that the church has celebrated for thousands of years.
Now I can hear conservatives thinking, you know, that's just anathema to them.
I know.
Do you think it's just going to be a matter of this sort of continuing acceptance of marriage equality?
Well, I do. I'm hopeful, and I know it's anathema to my conservative brothers and sisters, and they've got their stake in the ground, and they're not ever going to change and think that there's an eternal truth at stake here. But in fact, things do change, and I'm sad to say, a lot of times change more slowly in the church than they do in the culture. We were pretty sure, not so very, very long ago historically, that African American people were not equal to Euro-American, to white people, and in the church as well as in the culture. And the culture changed actually almost in concert with the church, but the church was not way ahead on that. The whole business of gender issues, we're still at some level within the Christian community still fighting that. There's still many evangelicals who don't want women pastors and don't want women church officers and have a concept of marriage and the role of women that's very, very different from the majority. But, in fact, those things changed. And we can quote people back in the 19th century who were absolutely sure that races needed to be separate and that it was an anathema to even think about integrating races. So culture changes, church changes. In some cases, the culture actually gets ahead of the church, and in this case, that's certainly the case here.
You know, I've always found that the church can be ahead of the curve and behind the curve at the same time.
Right, right.
I mean, you would think of something like civil rights.
Right.
Churches were in churches and temples and various congregations were in the forefront of the civil rights movement,
right.
And then there were others that lag.
Right, exactly. But those ones that were in the forefront were not there 50 years before. I mean, they underwent an enormous change, and that's one of the great stories of the church in our culture. And I'm kind of sinfully proud of my own denomination for, in fact, making that complete transition. Until the 1960s and 70s, Presbyterian denomination, at least, was deeply involved in the struggle for equal rights.
Yeah. And you've seen that play out. You were moderator of the Presbyterian Church, and you've seen that play out on the whole denominational issue.
Yes.
I think your own denomination, the last big fight was on divestment and of investment in Israel.
Right.
These are very contentious issues. Can you talk about how assembly either resolves them or in things like when you see the Episcopal Church and sometimes the Presbyterian Church itself, these don't get resolved and you have organizations split off.
Well, that's one of the tragedies of the whole religious story in the culture is that in far, far too many instances, people have decided that because they disagree, the disagreement is so profound that we can no longer call one another brothers and sisters and stay together in the same church. And that is happening with marriage equality. It certainly happened with race. It certainly happened with gender. One of the largest Presbyterian bodies in the country, the Presbyterian Church in America, actually pulled out of, these are congregations that pulled out of the mainstream over the issue of women's ordination. And they're a separate body now. So, yes, it's tragic. But on the other hand, in most of Protestantism, there's a basic respect for individual opinion and individual rights. And so these issues are they're new with each one that presents itself. But the whole notion of churches fighting over social issues is certainly not new. It's part of what it means to be a Protestant, certainly what it means to be a Presbyterian.
Well, we wish you great success with Christian Century Magazine, and we look forward to the Canepa lecture this Sunday. Dr. John Buchanan, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Dr. John Buchanan is the pastor emeritus at Fourth Presbyterian Church in Chicago and the editor and publisher of Christian Century Magazine. He'll be giving the 28th annual Canepa Interfaith Ecumenical Lecture this Sunday evening at 7 o'clock at Grace Lutheran Church at 5th Place and Lewis, and the lecture is free and open to the public. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Barry Friedman.
I have to tell you about the pennies. My father, for about the last 20 years, has been collecting pennies in a 3-foot plastic Coke bottle. He collects quarters, dimes, and nickels, too, kept in a casino bucket, which he cashes in every few months. But the pennies keep mounting. They're about halfway up the bottle. The cap, by the way, he's put scotch tape on to provide, you know, extra security. You know what the thing weighs, he tells me? You can't lift it. When he moved from New Jersey to Las Vegas, he took the pennies. When he moved from his apartment in Las Vegas to his home in Las Vegas, he took the pennies. And now he's moving to Tulsa. The move I'll tell you about some other time, but this is just about the pennies. I went out to Vegas a few weeks back to help him pack, and I saw the pennies by the door to the garage. We'll cash those in, I said. You can't keep schlepping the pennies around. What are you talking about? He said, I'm not cashing them in. What, are you crazy? Why would you pack a plastic Coke bottle full of pennies and take them to Oklahoma? Because they're my pennies. I mean, I hope they don't steal them. They steal these things, you know. The movers are not going to steal your pennies. You know what, he said? I'll just put them in the car, in the trunk. That's all. When they come to pick up the car, the pennies will be in the trunk. Don't get so shook up. You're serious about this. Go put the pennies in the trunk. I'm not putting the pennies in the trunk. You put the pennies in the trunk. Obviously, I put the pennies in the trunk. My father's 88. He's in good shape, but I can't have him lifting a 3-foot Coke bottle full of pennies. And let me just say, he's right. They're pretty heavy. And while I was there, what I did is I called the moving company that was taking the car, and I asked them, you know, what was prohibited. And I was told the usual stuff, flammable, alcohol, firearms. I couldn't bring myself to tell them about the trunk full of pennies. I was told to keep the weight down on the car to 50 pounds. Ruh-roh. I brought my father's bathroom scale out to the garage, took the pennies out of the trunk. 64 pounds of pennies. Dad, we got a problem. You can't take the pennies. Come on, what are you talking about? You got over 60 pounds worth of pennies. They only let you take 50. They won't ship them. What if I had a caddy instead of a Honda? Could I take them then? Yeah, but you don't have a caddy. You can't. What if we took some of the pennies out? Dad, I'm begging you. You can start collecting pennies again when you get to Oklahoma. We have pennies there, you know, I swear. You did this, he said. You did this. And what bothers me most, when you cash these pennies in at those machines at Smith's or Vaughn's, they take 10%, the miserable bastards. All right, go ahead, cash in the pennies. We'll go to dinner with the proceeds. Got to be 30, 40 bucks in there. As it turns out, he had $99 worth of pennies. Well, minus the VIG, he had about $87. Yeah, they took 11 bucks, those miserable bastards. Anyway, when I got back to the house, he had calmed down some, but he was still troubled. Now, maybe what really bothered him was the loss of something. Maybe the pennies represented control and that the thought of moving to Tulsa and eventually an assisted living facility, the loss of mobility and identity, maybe it was the realization he'd be leaving his friends from the bowling group. Maybe all that was wrapped up in that plastic Coke jar. Or maybe not. How'd you get the cap off, he asked, as I fed 10s and 20s into his open palm. I took the tape off. And then this, maybe what this was all about all along. Hey, did you bring back my bottle?
Barry Freeman is a writer, essayist, stand-up comedian, a columnist at the Tulsa Voice, and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you miss one of our recent episodes, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.